So nice to have you back, Scott.
Good to be here.
And let's get started with what's going on between Israel and Hezbollah. Last time we talked, there were some sort of pager bombing, walkie-talkie bombings. Right now we have fighter jets bombing the southern part of Lebanon, and Netanyahu trying to send a video message, which is the same that he has sent to Gazans. If you remember, in those days, he said that Hamas is your enemy. We are not your enemy. We are not going to kill you. It's Hamas that is killing you. And right now, he's just sending the same sort of message, Scott. Here is his...
People of Lebanon, Israel's war is not with you. It's with Hezbollah. For too long, Hezbollah has been using you as human shields. It placed rockets in your living rooms and missiles in your garage. Those rockets and missiles are aimed directly at our cities, directly at our citizens. To defend our people against Hezbollah strikes, we must take out those weapons. Now, starting this morning, the IDF has warned you to get out of harm's way. I urge you, take this warning seriously. Don't let Hezbollah endanger your lives and the lives of your loved ones. Don't let Hezbollah endanger Lebanon. Please, get out of harm's way now. Once our operation is finished, you can come back safely to your homes.
Yeah, if you replace Hezbollah with Hamas, it's the same kind of rhetoric.
Run back safely to your homes if we haven't blown them up, because we don't know what the hell we're doing, and we're targeting everything indiscriminately based upon generic intelligence, pure guesswork. He can say what he wants. First of all, the idea that Hezbollah and Lebanon are two distinct entities is ludicrous. Hezbollah is a political party, not just a militia movement, not just a political movement, but a political party, part of the Lebanese government, an important part of the Lebanese government. Hezbollah is Lebanon, and Lebanon is Hezbollah. That's the new reality, one that Netanyahu and the Israelis clearly haven't grasped. The other thing, your entire statement opening up focused solely on Israel's strikes against Lebanon. War is a two-way street, buddy. Lebanon, Hezbollah, is striking Israel. And this is the important fact, because the... besides my dogs taking umbrage at what I'm saying there, this is the danger of buying a puppy. He just decides to bark whenever he wants to. And right now they're chasing a cat around the floor.
Maybe someone is at the door.
It is what it is. But, Hezbollah is striking back at Israel. And this is the important thing. You see, this war is an extension of politics by other means. That's just a standard truism that Sun Tzu and Clausewitz and every military philosopher has acknowledged. You can't treat the military objectives separate from the political objectives, because the military objectives are designed to achieve the political objectives. Netanyahu has stated his political objectives. That is to return the 60,000 settlers who have been displaced from their homes back to their homes. In order to do that, he says he must defeat Hezbollah. Well, good luck. You tried that in 2006, you being Israel, and it didn't work. You couldn't stop Hezbollah from firing rockets into Israel. And in the end, Israel had to face a humiliating step down from their objectives of destroying Hezbollah. Well, he's done it again. All Hezbollah has to do to win is continue to fire rockets into northern Israel to ensure that the 60,000 settlers who have left their homes can't return home. And that's what's happening. But Hezbollah is also expanding the scope and scale of its strikes. So it's more than likely that tens of thousands of additional Israelis will be compelled to leave their homes, because Hezbollah is now striking targets in the Galilee and near Haifa. And Israel can't stop this. They can't defeat it. Hezbollah has been preparing for this conflict ever since 2006. The conflict ended. They're not stupid. They know what Israel can do. They've been aware of the weapon system Israel has procured. They fully anticipate this. There's nothing that Israel's doing right now that takes Hezbollah by surprise, other than the pager attack, which was an act of terrorism, which Hezbollah has adapted to. Israel now is apparently flooding the Bekaa Valley and other parts of Lebanon with leaflets that have a barcode or a QR code. And I guess in hopes that the person who receives it will get curious about it and click it on. Apparently it activates some sort of mechanism that drains, identifies the phone, drains the, because when you click on a QR code, you're linking yourself to a site. And that's run by Unit 8200, which will immediately infect your phone, drain the data, and then target you for death. Again, terrorism, because what happens if a kid picks it up and does it? What happens if a nurse, a doctor, somebody innocent picks it up and does it? You know, it's just part and parcel of the Israeli approach to this conflict, which is to be in total disregard for human life and for the laws of war.
And do you think to what extent they're willing to risk a conflict with Hezbollah? Do you think they're going to put troops on the ground if something goes wrong in that direction?
I mean, this morning, Israel indicated it was mobilizing two reserve brigades for duty in the north. What that means, we don't know. I can say this, Israel does not have the military capacity to push Hezbollah out of southern Lebanon, north of the Litani River. That's always been a stated military objective of Israel. They lack the capacity to do that. They lack the capacity when their military was intact. But now their military has been fighting for a year. Any forces that are being mobilized, any forces that exist are exhausted by this conflict, have suffered casualties, have suffered material losses, and have seen the morale of their troops plummet. They can't, I can guarantee you this, short of a few special forces units, and even those, I would imagine, have changed their attitude towards this conflict. There's no Israeli force that's saying, I want to go into southern Lebanon. They know that it's a death trap, suicide rap. Don't go in there. It's the same approach they have towards Gaza. There's no Israeli unit other than a handful of special forces units that are saying, I want to go into Gaza. I'm ready for it. They've been to Gaza. They're all dying. They've all been wounded. They recognize the futility of the operation. And so there's a lot of political posturing by Netanyahu. But, his war cabinet has rejected his demands for increased military operation. United States has said, no, we're not going to facilitate this. So we'll see. I think a lot of what Netanyahu does is domestic political posturing, designed to create the impression of action when in fact the action is impossible to undertake. We're going to strike Iran. No, you're not. We're going to go to war against Hezbollah. No, you're expanding operations, but it's a carefully managed game of escalation that's taking place right now. That doesn't mean that it can't spin out of control. That doesn't mean that there can't be a miscalculation or a misjudgment. But right now, I think there's more posturing than actual preparation for a full-scale conflict with Hezbollah.
Do you think the reason behind this new wave of tensions is because of these Israelis, that they want to send them to the northern part of Israel, or something else?
Say that one more time.
The reason behind this new escalation between Hezbollah and Israel is because of Israelis who are living in the northern part of Israel. That's why they want to send them to the northern part. And at the same time, they want to increase the tensions with Hezbollah because of these people.
I mean, that's the excuse, and it's a real excuse. Netanyahu is feeling serious political pressure domestically from these 60,000 settlers. If you recall, back when the strikes were first coming in out of Hezbollah, the Israelis pretty much abandoned the north in terms of air defense and put it all in the central part to protect it. And the north went, "What are you doing? We exist. We're here." And there's 60,000 settlers who have been compelled to leave their homes because of Hezbollah's actions, who, are suffering. They're, nobody wants to be a internally displaced person, and yet that's what they are. So there's a lot of pressure being put on Netanyahu to be seen as doing something. You can't just allow this the situation to continue. And so he has used this as the excuse, but he needed an excuse. He needed to do something. Notice he didn't initiate this action just with conventional military forces, because that alone would have exposed the emptiness of his rhetoric, because Israel's not prepared to go into full-scale combat with Hezbollah. He initiated by basically nullifying a decades-long intelligence operation to get explosive pagers into the hands of Hezbollah. You know, I believe that such an action was done to disrupt Hezbollah as a precursor to a massive military attack. I mean, because Israel knows Hezbollah's dug in. Hezbollah's got, you know, is ready for them. Hezbollah's been preparing for this. But this pager attack, this walkie-talkie attack, could have created a window of opportunity, a window of chaos, uncertainty, confusion that could have been exploited with lightning attacks, you know, designed to burst through defensive barriers, get in deep into the Latani, disrupt Hezbollah, and maybe, you know, in doing so, put Hezbollah behind the power curve where Hezbollah is reacting to Israel, not Israel reacting to Hezbollah. That's what it was designed to do. He gave it away. He threw it away just to get headlines, to say, oh, look, Netanyahu did something. Israel did something. Oh, they got headlines. Today, it doesn't matter. Hezbollah's adapted. It's over. They threw that away. This tells me that what Netanyahu is doing is more political than military. It's about salvaging his fragile right-wing political coalition. It's about buying time to stave off the domestic attacks that are taking place, political attacks. You know, it wasn't but just a week ago, hundreds of thousands of Israelis are in the streets demanding Netanyahu resign because of the hostage crisis. That hasn't gone away. Now you add to that 60,000 internally displaced persons who are saying, we want to go home. There's a lot of pressure on Netanyahu.
And we had the new president of Iran, Pezeshkian, is now in the United States. He was talking about the conflict in the Middle East between Israel and Hezbollah and about what has happened in Gaza and what is happening right now. He said it seems that the outcome of what he was talking about was the Iran is willing to talk with the United States in order to make some sort of sanity, some sort of understanding on the part of the United States and Iran to bring some sort of sanity to end this conflict in the Middle East. But do you find any sort of understanding on the part of Washington to be willing to talk with Iran in order to bring these tensions down?
Well, absolutely. There's a willingness to talk in the United States, and it transcends political parties. Donald Trump, just on the campaign trail, said he's ready to lift sanctions against Iran and talk to Iran to bring this nonsense to an end, because he says we've lost Iran. We've lost it because of our sanctions, because of our action. We've lost it. We have no ability to interact in a meaningful fashion with Iran. The Biden administration recognizes this as well. And the Iranians are very pragmatic. We've had this conversation before. Everybody is out there saying, you know, death to America. Iran doesn't want to talk. I say, you're hiring a kite. Iran wants to survive and thrive. They don't want to go to war. They're not looking for perpetual war. Yes, there are elements in Iran that exploit passions passionately. Death to America has become, you know, the Iranian version of USA, USA, USA. They just chant it, but they don't mean it. What they want is stability. And, you know, they see an opportunity here to, you know, Iran has facilitated the strategic defeat of Israel. I mean, we can sit here and talk about Israel bombing this, Israel doing that. Let's look at it. Economically, Israel's trashed. The southern port of Eilat's done, shut down. Billions of dollars lost. Their economy is totally on life support. Nobody's investing money in Israel. The whole concept of the Indian Middle East Economic Corridor that's supposed to be the lifeblood for Israel in the region, that's dead in the water. Saudi Arabia says we won't normalize relationships with Israel until there's a Palestinian state and its capital is in Jerusalem. Okay, that means Saudi Arabia is never going to be doing it because the Israeli state as it's currently configured can't do that. Militarily, they can't sustain this. If they do this, they'll collapse sometime next year. There's widespread admission that that is indeed the case. Domestic, in terms of you know, the domestic reality, Israel was meant for people to come there and bask in the sun and live a comfortable life at the expense of the Palestinian people, nonetheless, but live a comfortable life. Israel doesn't exist when people are hiding in bomb shelters, can't go home, can't do their work. Israel ceases to exist at that point in time. And at some point in time, if this continues, Israeli society is going to collapse. You're going to see millions flee. And once enough people flee and the demographics drop to a certain level, the sustainability of a Jewish state called Israel is nil. That's the reality. Iran has achieved this. They've achieved this by supporting Hamas. They've achieved this by supporting Hezbollah, by the Houthi, by the Iraqi militias, by the Syrian militias, by its own presence. This is a strategic victory that Iran has achieved. Now, you don't want to press this issue to the point, though, where Iran starts to pay a detrimental price. Iran, like Russia, is focused on what's going to happen in Kazan, Russia, on October 22nd through 24th, the BRICS summit. Iran is a member of BRICS. This is a multipolar, consensus-driven organization that has surpassed the G7 in terms of geopolitical relevance. Iran's part of that. And being part of it, there's an economic aspect of it too. Iran's also part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. There's a huge economic component. Iran is focused on being part of this new Eurasian Economic Union. All of this stuff implies, because to succeed economically, you have to have stability. And Iran can't have stability if it's at war with Israel. So, or in a situation where the United States won't talk to it because of the nuclear issues that are outstanding. The United States is ready to make compromises. I believe Iran is ready to not compromise fundamentals, but to enter a negotiation that reduces, not enhances, the prospects of war with either the United States or Israel. This is what a good leader of a nation does. Tries to avoid conflict, find diplomatic off-ramps. I think this is natural. He ran on this platform. Why is anybody surprised? You do know, I mean, you, of course, know how the Iranian system works. Yes, they had an election. I believe that it's a democratic election, more democratic than many places. I don't believe an election was stolen. I think Iranians went to the poll, they voted, and the results are clear. They put in this man who is less conservative than his counterparts was. He ran on a platform, but you know that platform, before he could even put it out there, had to pass the litmus test of the Guardian Council and go up to the Assembly of Experts and get the Supreme Leader saying, okay, if this guy is elected, we're going to have to deal with this platform. And it's a platform we're willing to deal with. So he's not going against the grain here. When he says, I want to have this conversation, it's something that has the approval of the Supreme Leader and the mechanisms of governance in Iran. He's not a free agent. He's not a rogue agent. He's not out there doing things that are incompatible with the theocracy, with the Islamic Republic. He is the Islamic Republic. And so, the fact is, we shouldn't be talking about the Iranian president wanting to do this. He is the face of Iran right now. Iran wants to do this. All of Iran wants to do this because they understand the consequences of war with Israel. They don't want a war with Israel. They don't want a war with America. They want peace. They want stability. And the United States is in a situation right now where it's looking at Netanyahu commit national suicide in Israel and trying to bring the whole world down with him. And so they need to build guardrails here to manage the insanity of Israel and bringing, creating stability with Iran. The mere fact that you can have them talking with Iran reduces the possibility of unforeseen consequences, accidental incidents, because we now, whether it's going to be direct conversations or through an intermediary, I think initially all Iranian-American connectivity is done through an intermediary, but a trusted intermediary who can say, hey, the Iranians called, they don't want a war with Israel. You guys need to put pressure on Israel to stop this. Or, hey, the Americans called, man, what you're doing there is not helpful to this overall objective. Communication. The more people yak, 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 the less people bang, bang, bang. And that's always a good thing.
Yeah, we had a meeting between the foreign minister of Iran and Saudis in New York, and they were hugging, kissing. But we know, Scott, Erdogan was talking about the conflict even between Hezbollah and Israel. Saudis are the same. Iran is thinking the same. They want a better relationship with the United States. And And I would argue that Iran definitely wants a better relationship with the United States. But at the end of the day, do you think that the policymakers in Washington consider any sort of relationship between Iran or even a better Middle East with all these countries together, a better relationship with Washington, which would benefit both parties? And how do they see it in terms of the way that Netanyahu is capable of manipulating each and everything related to the Middle East?
Well, first of all, I think we have to recognize that Netanyahu is a self-limiting phenomena, meaning he's not going to be in power forever. He exists right now, but, the Biden administration isn't happy with him. I believe Donald Trump understands Netanyahu's the problem, not the solution. That at the end of the day, this crisis will be the end of Netanyahu. How long this takes, we don't know. But you have to, I think all parties agree we have to collectively write out the Netanyahu era. When Netanyahu is no longer politically relevant, there will have to be collective decision on how to proceed with Israel. And I think it's sort of good that Iran is willing to talk in an effort to create stability, not instability. I think, Iran is not stupid either. They've achieved far too much to throw it away. When I say stability, I'm not talking about letting Israel get off the hook. I think Iran is going to keep as much pressure on Israel as possible, but it has to manage that. It has to manage the pressure, because without the pressure, there's no incentive of the United States to get engaged. But it can't be too much pressure that it distracts Iran from its strategic objective of being a meaningful part of BRICS, working with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization to make the European Economic Union viable, relevant. So Iran is, the only way you do this is through engagement, by talking. If you think you know the outcome of a negotiation when you sit down at the negotiating table, you've never negotiated with somebody, especially on complicated issues. You come in with what you say you want. They come in with what they say you want. The whole process is about communication and reaching a compromise that both sides can agree to. It's not a negotiation. If you come and say my way or the highway, that's a surrender. The other side's surrendering. The United States is not prepared to surrender to Iran, and Iran is not prepared to surrender to the United States. Both sides have their red lines, but what we found is that red lines themselves are flexible as long as they don't compromise underlying principles. I don't think Iran is ever going to give up on the fundamental right of nuclear enrichment. But would Iran be willing to accept certain limitations, restrictions to that? I think the answer is yes. What limitations, restrictions? Iran's not going to commit. You don't give away your hands. You come in and say, this is my red line. And then you get to a point where you almost got everything you want, but this is holding it up. You have to sit back and say, can we bend on this? How far can we bend on this to get the Americans? You find that sweet spot, bam, now you have an agreement. And I think the United States is at the point where it recognizes that the JCPOA was the original Iran nuclear deal. Failed because it wasn't a treaty. Not that treaties matter anymore. Trump just withdrew from a couple of them. But I also think Trump realizes he made mistakes there too. I think, Donald Trump has learned. So I don't know who's going to be the president, Trump or Harris. Harris is part of an administration that's, is recognizing the limitations of American power. But there's not much that Biden can do right now. He's literally a lame duck president. And he has to tread water until the next president is elected. Biden's hoping it will be Harris. There'll be some sort of continuity of policy. But even, when they came in, the Biden administration said that read their national security strategy. The number one goal of the United States, of the national security strategy, is to preserve and enhance the rules-based international order. But if you've been listening to Biden and Sullivan talk, they all acknowledge that the rules-based, first they said the rules-based international order is under attack. Now they're saying the rules-based international order is getting routed, that they have problems, that it's losing relevance. And how do you have to adjust now to new realities. And it's this adjustment that creates opportunities for new policy, new relationships, new negotiations. And I think Iran is taking advantage of that. The Iranians aren't stupid. Again, Americans, I don't know what most Americans think of Iran. I don't think they hold Iran into high regard. They view Iran as a nation dominated by, religious zealots, these theocrats who all they want to do is whip women and cause problems, but behead men, hang them. Iran's about hanging, not beheading. Saudi Arabia beheads. Of course, that exists. You can find the video clips of the women who violated the hijab rules and they're getting whipped up on. You can find videotapes of the Iranians, hanging guys in the middle of the street. That happens. I've been to Iran. You know what else I found? Some of the most educated people on the planet. I just remember walking through Tehran, downtown Tehran, and I was expecting, the Iranian intelligence services to stalk me. I'm sure they were following me in some form, but it wasn't obvious. I could go anywhere I wanted to. I didn't try to break the rules or bend, but I got up in the morning. I wandered the town, hired a tour coordinator, went out and saw Iran. This guy was stalking me though. And I'm like, what the hell's going on here? And I went into a restaurant and he came in and I'm like, oh man, this can be one of those confrontation things. And he sat down and he introduced himself. He said, "You're Scott Ritter." I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Yeah, I thought I recognized you. Why are you in Iran?" I said, "Well, I'm here to try and, talk about nuclear issues and all that." And he's like, "Oh, no, please don't do that. Because you went to Iraq and you did that. And then the American invaded Iraq. Are you coming here to be the precursor to invade Iran?" But the bottom line is this guy knew everything. And as people heard me talk with him, people just started coming around. And soon the whole restaurant, we're having a little mini seminar there, give and take. People who couldn't speak English were using translators, and I'm answering questions, and it was just very pleasant. They knew everything. They knew everything, unless this was a setup where they secretly had a university class of advanced graduate students. But this wasn't a setup. I picked the restaurant to go into, and it was the people that came around, and they knew everything. The housewives, the man on the street, the old guy drinking tea. They were knowledgeable, educated, locked in. Another time I was at a restaurant and talking with my host, who was a former Revolutionary Guard guy. And he said, "Do you mind if some people join us?" I said, "Okay, bring them over." Well, they were people from the Revolutionary Guard. They were they're in the intelligence corps and they were the American division of it. And they all came in. They wanted to talk to the American. And I said, "Sure, I don't have any secrets. Let's talk." And we had a long time. These guys were smart. They were locked in, very well informed. And talk about politics. They all admitted under my interrogation that they had committed acts of terrorism and acts of murder. Two of them had been in Europe assassinating Kurds back in the early 80s. Other ones, all the others were involved in the suppression of the MEK, which was very violent. And I said, "So you guys literally are terrorists." They said, "Well, under your definition, yeah, we did what you accused us of doing." He said, "But we've learned. The guys that were in Berlin killing Kurds said, we came back here, and the first thing we did is met with the leadership and say, hey, this death to the West kind of stuff. We don't have to buy into everything they do, prostitution, porn shops, drugs, and all that. No, we don't need that. But the West works. The West functions. I mean, things work over there that don't work here. We need to have a change in our attitude towards this." And you noticed when Rafsanjani was the president, the change took place. Rafsanjani was open to this. And there's always been an element in Iran open to that. And a lot of the impetus for being open to the West came from the Revolutionary Guard, not the liberals in northern Tehran, but from the radicals who were radicalized, who realized that radicalization isn't the solution. Iran is a fascinating country, but the Americans are so unaware of, uneducated about. The same thing with Russia. It's the same concept. We have our prejudices and everything, but the Iranians are a nation that's been around a long time and has great culture, a great sense of history, and Iran's place in history. And I think we need to respect the fact that the Iranian leadership, whether we agree with their religious beliefs and their, you know, fundamental, you know, some fundamental issues of their national definition, it's okay. They don't agree with us. You know, it doesn't mean we have to go to war. But they know where they want to go, and they have a good idea of how they're going to get there. And it's going to be through negotiation, not through violence.
Yeah. The president of Iran, Pezeshkian, had an interview with Fareed Zakaria on CNN in which he was responding to how Iran would react, would respond to the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh. Here is what he said. So.
President of the United States of America.
The government of Israel would, of course, say that the reason they are retaliating against Hezbollah is Hezbollah has been raining rockets in northern Israel, has driven 60, 70,000 people out of their homes. These are men, women, and children. These are civilians. And that Israeli response is a response to that, those Hezbollah rocket attacks.
Do you believe that? In Gaza, the same Israel, how many people have they murdered? More than 41,000 people. What have they done to the Israelis for them to deserve to have their hospitals, their schools, men, women, children, old and young, targeted? How many Israelis were killed in response to which they have killed so many, tens of thousands? Did the children kill anyone? Did the women murder anyone? Is someone who's hospitalized murder anyone? Today at the United Nations, they were saying that 200 United Nations personnel were martyred in this, in that, on that land. So who believes really what Israel says now? If Hezbollah can muster the strength to even, let's assume, rain down thousands of rockets, how many people have they killed? Israel, on the other hand, they commit acts of terror. They go wherever they wish. They attack countries at will. They go wherever they wish and commit assassinations. They've done that for decades. And the greatest international government committing international acts of terror is Israel. Today, through their paramilitary and other organizational personnel, UAVs, aerial bombardments, they're committing these crimes every day. And on the night of my inauguration as the new president of the Islamic Republic of Iran, they came to our capital city and they martyred Ismail Haniyeh. Who does that? Now, these are terrorists, the ones who wish to only defend their land and their dignity and their country. You know, coming up with the appropriate and right numbers is not that big of an effort. Let's see how many have been victims of those who commit the actual terror and how many lives have been lost for defending one's dignity and territorial integrity. Who is it in this framework that has no value for humanity? And the world sees this, the world witnesses this, and the powers are defending this, the powers that are so-called defenders of human rights. This is embarrassing.
You have said that Iran reserves the right to respond in the time, manner, and place of its choosing to the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh. Are you saying that you will for sure respond in some way to that assassination?
If international organizations cannot make this individual sit down and stand down, and they keep allowing someone who unfortunately has the means to commit such atrocities, then naturally we will give the appropriate response.
Yeah. Scott, in your opinion, what was the essence of what he was talking about in terms of the way that we have to find a solution for what's going on with Israel in order to all of this assassination that has been going on for decades?
Well, the first thing is he made it clear that there's no moral equivalence between Israel and Hezbollah. It's not Israel that comes out on top. He made it clear that Israel is the evil, is the bad, is doing the wrong, that you can't, you know, Fareed Zakaria's you know, question, the implication was that it's Hezbollah that is the root of all problems here. No, Israel is the root of all problems. But the fascinating thing and the big takeaway here is he didn't say, yes, Iran will strike. We have to strike. We're going to strike at a time and place of our choosing. He didn't say that. What he said is, if the world can't make this man sit down, if you can't bring an end to these policies, then we have no choice but to do something about it. But if Iran is not going to be the destabilizer here, that if stability and peace can be brought into the region, then Iran, you know, isn't going to say, oh yeah, but you know, you killed this guy back you know, in July, so we have to bomb you. I know everything's going well. I know peace is breaking out all over, but we got to bomb you. That's not what they're saying. They're saying, basically saying, we're willing to draw a line and say what's done is done, if we can get, you know, an outcome that is acceptable. And he didn't put down unrealistic things. He didn't talk about the death to Israel, the elimination of Israel, because I think he knows strategically there's a momentum in that direction that, you know, is going to happen no matter what. He's simply talking about bringing an end to Israel's ongoing genocide against the Gazans and their terrorism of the Lebanese people. And that's probably the most reasonable stance one could expect from Iran at this time.
Yeah. We had an article in Bloomberg. It was talking about that. It seems that Zelensky's victory plan is not working. Nobody's considering this plan. And they were talking about that the NATO countries are putting some sort of pressure on Zelensky to go after negotiations. And on the other hand, we had this talk on the part of Stoltenberg. He was talking about the way that they're gonna continue the conflict in Ukraine.
We can change President Putin's mind, but we can change his calculus. So if the price he has to pay on the battlefield is too high, then he may be willing to sit down and agree a solution where Ukraine prevails as a sovereign independent nation. And to get there, we need military support to Ukraine, because that's the only way to convince President Putin that they will not win on the battlefield.
Can you put both of them together? I don't understand. Russian, how do they think right now about what's going on in the West? Because mixed messages are coming out.
Have you ever gone to Las Vegas?
No.
But you know a lot. In Brazil, yeah. There are casinos? Right. So you know the concept of gambling.
Yeah.
And you know that the odds are in favor of the house. That's why they have big buildings with fancy carpets and big chandeliers and all that kind of stuff, because in the long run, you're not going to make money at a casino. The odds are in favor of the house. When you take a look at NATO and Russia and Ukraine, and you just put everything on the table, in the long run, Russia will win this conflict 100% of the time because of all the factors that could be brought in. NATO was gambling that, because you know, I can go to Las Vegas. I can put $500 in my pocket and walk around and play the craps table and wait till I'm up and then leave with a little bit of profit, go there, wait till I leave. If I lose a little bit, walk away, and I can manage it. And I may get lucky enough to walk out with more money in my pocket than I came in with, but it's not going to happen a lot. It's a gamble that's going to happen. NATO gambled that they were going to be able to put all this resources into Ukraine to create this proxy that would have, that would create a resource problem for Russia. They were also gambling that they could combine the military pressure with the economic pressure, that they could sanction Russia and get the economy to break. And they were gambling that the economy would cause the political will of the Russian people to collapse, and that the confluence of military defeat, economic disaster, and loss of political support would lead to Putin's demise. All right, that's like me walking into a casino and saying, I'm going to simultaneously play blackjack, roulette, and craps. And I have to win on all three and in order to make money. It's stupid. Never was going to happen. Anybody with a head on their shoulders would have known that the sanctions were going to work. Hell, I wrote about it in December of 2021. Detailed paper said exactly what was going to happen. And you know what? Everything happened the exactly way I said. Why? Because it had to. The reality of Russian energy and the pricing, the scope and the scope and scale of Russia's engagement with Europe, that you can't walk away from that, re-engage and expect to make money. It was inevitable that the European economy was going to collapse because of the blowback from the Russian sanctions. What wasn't inevitable was that Russia was going to succeed to the level they did. Even I didn't predict that. What I said is that Russia would be able to manage its economic difficulties better than Europe would, that Europe would collapse before Russia collapsed. What I didn't predict is that as Europe collapses, Russia says, screw it, we're going to expand. We got this under control. Russia's thriving today. Thriving. I've been there. I'm just telling you. It's not just Moscow and St. Petersburg. It's all of Russia. It's an economic boom. It's, you know, people are employed. They have good life, standards of living, quality of life, infrastructure, all the things that the West claims Russia doesn't have, they have. Yeah, they got flushing toilets too, everywhere. It's just crazy, the stupidity in the West. But we didn't predict that, but it did. On the military, there was no way this was ever going to work. First of all, understand this, that NATO is a paper tiger. You know, they have some militaries. If you've learned anything, taking a force out of garrison, it's one thing for the Poles, for instance, to say, we have this many troops. Sure, they're all in garrison, right? And you've been working on maintaining your equipment, haven't you? And you've gone to the field a couple times, right? Now take them all out of garrison, march them, and take them, project them 100 kilometers into Western Ukraine. And if you haven't practiced that, you're going to die, because that's a completely different game. Now you're in the field. You don't get to go back to your maintenance facility to maintain. You have to have field maintenance. Have you practiced that? Do you have the spare parts? Do you have the fuel? Do you have the ammunition? Do you have the ability to protect that line of communication? Do you have the ability to communicate amongst your troops? All the things that if you don't do, you fail. Russia's been doing it now for 2.5 years, more. They know war better than anybody. See, the Ukrainians used to know war, but this is the third time their army's been destroyed. They're creating a fourth time, and you were talking about bringing in people with no military training. You know what the Russians do better than anybody? Kill. You know what the hardest thing is to train a soldier in peacetime? To kill. There's a book called On Killing, written by, I can't remember the author, an American author. He talks about World War II, you know, with all the fighting, soldiers don't know how to kill, and they don't want to kill. That the vast majority of people just fired their weapon and the bullets went whenever they went. Very rarely did you get a guy who would actually aim and take people out. It takes a while to condition somebody to take a human life. The Russian army right now kills without hesitation. Not indiscriminately, but without hesitation. They go head-to-head with a NATO force full of people who have never killed anybody, don't know what it's like to be shot at. It's like boxers. You know, it's not just about you punching somebody. It's about somebody punching you. And you got to not only be able to deliver a punch, but you got to be able to take a punch. You got to know how to manage the fight. Russia knows how to manage this fight. NATO doesn't. Militarily, NATO is never going to be able to impose its will on Russia. Russia was always going to be able to adjust. It has better resources. It's fighting on interior lines of communication. So militarily, this was never going to end well for NATO. They were gambling that they could achieve localized military success for a brief period of time, which combined with economic collapse and political chaos could lead to a result. The economy didn't collapse, so Russia never felt that pressure. And the Russian people, again, if you study history, you'd know that this is a guaranteed outcome, have rallied around their government. There's more support for this conflict today than there has been at any time. And the Russian military is getting stronger and stronger and stronger. So this is the reality that Europe, the United States, and everybody is facing. You aren't going to change this. You went in and you gambled. We're now 2 years into somebody sitting at the casino putting good money after bad. We are so deep in the hole right now that we could win for a year and never recover. And we're not going to win for a year. The more you gamble, the more desperate you get. The less you focus on the odds and you're just going for that one miraculous thing, the storm shadow. Just give me the storm shadow. Give me the ATACMS. Give me the F-16. Give me something that will miraculously change the reality, which is Ukraine has lost. There is no Ukrainian plan for victory. Everybody who's looked at it laughs at it, says it's a joke. isn't going to happen. Nobody's going to support this. Nobody is supporting it. Ukraine has lost this war. The West is adapting to this reality. There are political leaders who have invested so much political capital into the notion of defeating Russia that they can't back down. But guess what? The foundation that put them into power and holds them into power is collapsing. Look at Germany, Olaf Scholz. Compare and contrast statements he's making today with what he said a year ago in 2023, when he was literally Adolf Hitler. We're going to march into you. We're going to do this. Today, we're not sending you Taurus. We're not supporting this stupid plan. We're not going to do any of this. Why? Because Germany is falling apart. Scholz is looking at the results. He's a politician. Politician's job is to get reelected. And he's looking at the reality of the German electorate, and he's saying, I ain't getting reelected, especially if I continue with this stupid war, which is destroying our economy and making us look foolish around the world. Complete 180. Other nations like the Czech Republic, they got a president, former military officer, NATO guy. We're strong. Yeah, the Czech people went, no, we're not doing this. Slovakia, same thing. Hungary, boom. Europe starting to fall away. France, even Macron, who, again, just 6 months ago, were sending the French Foreign Legion into Ukraine. I said, no, you're not. And he didn't. Can't. There's nothing there. But now he's saying we have to talk with Russia. Saying this war will end, and when the war ends, we have to talk with Russia. We have to repair this. Okay, the war will end, but it's not going to end on terms favorable to Ukraine. In fact, Ukraine won't exist when this war ends, not as it currently configured. Zelensky, he's another person like Netanyahu that we just have to wait for Zelensky to disappear. And I think he will disappear sometime in the not so distant future, because his political relevance, his political viability is nil. And when they replace him, somebody will come in and have to accept the reality that peace will only come by terms dictated by Russia. The West is recognizing that. They're trying to, mitigate the terms that Russia will impose. But they're going to be harsh. Demilitarization, denazification, hopefully the end of Banderist ultranationalism. This cancer on not just Ukraine, but Europe and the world needs to be, for once and for all, have a spike driven through its heart. And permanent neutrality. Ukraine will never be a member of NATO. Whether it becomes a member of the European Union is another question. It doesn't qualify, and it's not going to qualify for decades. What it could become is a member of a political economic union with Russia and Belarus, and have a chance to, get some viability back. But we'll see what the future holds. But there is no Zelensky peace plan. It doesn't exist. It's in his imagination, but nobody treats it seriously.
Yeah. Last time we talked about that meeting between Starmer and Biden, you mentioned that you don't know who has changed Biden's decision not to send long-range missiles to Ukraine. Then later on we learned it was Pentagon decided to do that. But who did that, Scott, in your opinion? Was Lloyd Austin? And what information they've received based on that, those information, they have decided not to send long-range missiles to Ukraine?
Well, Lloyd Austin had already made this decision based upon assessments from the Pentagon. He, I think, September 6th, I could be off on that date, he went to the 24th iteration of the Ramstein contact group. That's where they all get together, the Americans, the Europeans, the Ukrainians, and they talk about what's next in terms of supplying support. And at that time, Zelensky had come in making a heavy pitch for U.S. permission to use ATACMS and Storm Shadows. And Austin said, no, there's no such thing as a silver bullet. And he said something else. He said, this war is going to end through negotiations, not by, applying, magical weapons. So that was a big no. And one of the reasons is that it was escalatory in nature, needlessly provocative, and not going to change the outcome. But that appeared to be policy coming from the Pentagon. Apparently, the State Department had different point of view. Tony Blinken now is flying, or not, taking a train to Kiev, and he's saying the whole time, our policy is that Ukraine will win this war. And the president's saying, we'll win this war. And remember, the definition of victory is strategic defeat of Russia, which, given the fact that Russia is a nuclear power. Strategic defeat means you'll, automatically trigger their nuclear doctrine and the world ends. So it's a stupid suicidal policy to begin with, but that's our policy, the defeat of Russia, victory for Ukraine. And he and the foreign secretary of England go to there. And again, the press, remember, the press doesn't invent stuff all the time. On occasion, they're told, what's going to happen. And the press that's following, the gaggle that's following these guys, was told that Blinken and Lammy are going to sit down and they're going to give the green light for Ukraine to use his way. And Ukraine fully expected that. And then Blinken comes out and gives some wishy-washy language about now's not the time, we're not going to do this, or da-da-da-da-da. Because I think Austin went to the White House and said, what are you doing? And so then the president said, Jake Sullivan came in and said, this will be handled by executive decision, because we got the Pentagon, the State Department, they're not talking with each other, policy disconnect, the White House is going to take this over. Jake Sullivan, in charge. And Keir Starmer now is going to fly to New York, to Washington, D.C., and meet with Biden at the White House. And Keir Starmer comes off with his red briefcase. It's got all the plans and everything. Remember, Zelensky and the British had already worked out the targeting. Zelensky had the targets. He was trying to sell the targets. The British had the targets. Remember what I'm saying. The British had the targets. What's that tell the Russians? Who's attacking what? It's the British attacking them using American intelligence. That's what the Russians said all along. But he came in. The whole thing was Russia's bluffing, Russia's bluffing, Russia's bluffing. And Biden was ready to do on this. He was told, this is what we're going to do. Sullivan told him everything. Okay, the Russians are bluffing. They all heard Putin speak on Thursday night and they went, nah, he's bluffing. Suddenly you have the ambassador, the Russian ambassador to the United Nations in session at the Security Council of the United Nations, basically say this will be a declaration of war. He said that to the world. And now Biden's like, well, what does that mean, declaration? I don't. And then Anatoly Antonov says, if you think you can avoid nuclear conflict and limit it just to Europe, think what I'm just saying right there. If you think you can avoid a nuclear conflict and limit it just to Europe, you're wrong. You will get burned. Your fingers will get burned. And now they're going, what does that mean? And so the White House calls its intermediaries, all the former government officials who, because they're not in government, maintain some sort of, casual connectivity with the Russians. And they all call Anatoly Antonov and say, what do you mean by that? He said, what do you think I mean? The president's word were quite clear. Don't play with fire. And they all start calling Sullivan saying, this is a problem. The Russians aren't bluffing. They appear to be serious about this. And Biden had to pull the plug on signing the documents. I personally believe there was also a back channel, probably through the Pentagon, maybe through the CIA, maybe through both, where the Russians... Let me give you an example. If you remember back in the fall of 2022, when Ukraine launched its big counterattack in Kharkov, and the Russians fell back and they recaptured Kherson. Everybody in the West was saying Russia's going to use a nuclear weapon because they're so desperate. Total misanalysis. But they said Russia can use a nuke. The United States used the back channel to Russia. And they didn't just say, don't do it. They said, if you do it, this will happen. We will strike you using conventional weapons, but it'll be a massive strike designed to, destroy communications, logistics, command and control. We're coming in hard. It's a guarantee. We're not going to nuke you. But if you use nuclear weapons against Ukraine, NATO is going to hit you hard conventionally, and this is how we're going to do it. I think the Russians went, thanks for that intelligence. We weren't planning on nuking them anyways, but hey, that's your thing. But my point is, this channel isn't just about issuing soft warnings. The channel is about issuing very detailed warnings. And I have a feeling that the Russians went to him and said, if this happens, this is what we're going to do. I don't know what they were going to do. I don't think it was going to be nuclear. I think it was going to be conventional, but I think it would have been involved strategic weapons, avant-gardes, Kinzhals, Zircons. I was in a space, as they call it, on X. And the deputy ambassador to the United Nations for Russia, Mr. Ambassador Poyansky, was there. And I postulated my theories about Russian doctrine, etc. And he said, look, I can't talk about it for obvious reasons. But he said, I will tell you right now that you won't get any disagreement from any Russians about what you just said. So I feel comfortable with what I'm saying. I think the Russians made it clear that there would be consequences. And the problem is, once you get into this tit for tat, because if Russia then, you remember how the NATO said, we're going to hit Russia hard with conventional? I think Russia came back and said, we're going to hit you hard with conventional. And then what happens? Article 5 is triggered. And Putin already said, he told Macron, he told everybody else, once NATO triggers Article 5, we're at war. And it will go nuclear. 72 hours later, we're all dead. So I think that's what happened. And unfortunately, I got to run because okay. I have another commitment.
Thank you so much, Scott, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.